Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Is the computer the elephant in the exam room?
It has skewed the focus of the visit too much around keeping the record, making the record pretty, as opposed to the main purpose of the visit, which is to take care of the patient.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You measure a sample, but you measure millions and billions of molecules all at the same time.
You get to see these patients over and over again. They become part of your family.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
You know, everything falls apart.
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy? Plus,
bingo.
So here's this population that never gets studied.
Pretty much all of cell biology
there
needs to kind of be redone.
For
I first
tests.
Opened a little
this
box
before.
On today's show, high-tech medicine, technology that changes treatments like games for stroke recovery or implants to regain hearing, technology that predicts health and safety risks, and a look at how digital innovation is changing the way medicine is practiced. Let's start with that. If you asked me right now what my thyroid or my cholesterol levels were during my last physical, I can go online and I can tell you, all right, once I reset my password, I can tell you that my triglycerides were elevated at 172, but my HDL was looking good at 59. My own data only goes back to 2011. I have no clue where I could find the rest of my medical history, but the fact that I can even look up this tiny fraction is nothing short of a revolution. One that was a long time in the making. Hospitals and doctors were really slow in adopting electronic records until the federal government provided major financial incentive with stimulus package money. All right, who remembers the stimulus package?
We're taking the most meaningful steps in years towards modernizing our healthcare system. It's an investment that will take the long overdue step of computerizing America's medical records to reduce the duplication and waste that costs billions of healthcare dollars and medical errors that cost thousands of lives each year.
Quick flashback to 2009, that was President Obama. Moving patient records from papers onto computers was also supposed to increase our access to health records. And there is still a lot of tension in that area. Enter Regina Holiday. She's made access to patient records her passion, and it was fueled by her own family's suffering. In this digital realm, she uses an old-school weapon, paint. Alana Gordon brings us her story.
Just 6 days after Regina Holiday's husband died, she started painting this mural on the side of a gas station off a busy street in Washington, D.C.
So Fred's in the center of the painting. I started with Fred because I wanted to have him back so desperately. So he's back within the painting.
Regina made this in June of 2009. Her husband Fred's decline from kidney cancer had been quick. He passed away just 12 weeks after being diagnosed. He was 39. He was the love of her life. The two shared a passion for film and theater. They had two young kids. Fred's depicted in this mural, which spans the length of a parking lot, lying on a hospital bed, eyes closed, his left arm dangling off the side. He's holding a pen. A doctor's nearby on a cell. Others are looking at a computer or adjusting Fred's IV. And then there's Regina. She's across from Fred, stretched between him and a nurse. She has three faces. It's jarring.
I've got a plastic Halloween mask on facing my husband, and that plastic Halloween mask is a pretty girl. Because what I'm trying to be is this pretty, loving wife while my husband's going through all this. And you can't see my face beneath that, the struggling face, right?
Holiday designed this mural during Fred's roller coaster of care. She says it was a constant battle to get information, to understand what was going on and what he needed. She says doctors told her to stop asking questions. The mural contains quotes and symbols. A big one is 73 cents in change, right beneath Regina. It's what one hospital wanted to charge her per page to access Fred's medical records in the midst of their crisis. She says they told her it would be a 21-day wait.
It's sort of like a slap in the face Like, really? Really? After all that you've done, after the $60,000 it just cost to be in this hospital, you're going to charge me 73 cents per page just to see the information that we've already paid for? We've paid for all these services. There's no other industry that charges you for the receipt.
Holiday says vital information was in that record, information that even without a college degree, she felt she could identify and ensure he got better care. She'd have known where his tumors were so AIDS wouldn't touch them and accidentally break his bones. Or she'd be able to see early on that he had an infected bladder and needed a catheter.
Because we were on this roller coaster of care where we didn't know what was going to happen to us next, and it's almost impossible to be able to make decisions without access to information.
Regina saw technology as being designed for the healthcare system, but not for the patients. And it's meant that many families, not just hers, have suffered. Regina has left to paint, and she made the case to the gas station that a mural would solve their graffiti problem. So she channeled her anger and grief into art, and in doing so, turned this mural into a sort of ground zero for a patient movement in the electronic medical record world. Because a little lady making a big splash about her husband's hospital nightmare on a busy DC street, smack dab in the middle of heated healthcare debates that were leading up to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, caught some people's attention.
I talked to hundreds of people while I was painting this painting, because people would come up to me and they'd start sharing me their healthcare stories. They started sharing what happened to them and their mom and their dad, and some of them were horrific stories. But it was good to talk to people who were as equally broken as I was.
Soon, Regina was being invited to press conferences with lawmakers. She attended public meetings on the Hill, asking questions about the needs of patients in designing health technology policies. She gained a following. Social media helped. And about 2 years in, her mural art changed course. I guess you could say it caught some new legs. Literally.
Somebody reached out to me on Twitter, and they wanted to wear a patient's story in a medical conference where patients were not invited. And so I painted the story of Fred and I on her back. And so she wore it, and she talked about it.
From there, Holiday started painting stories of other people's healthcare experiences on their suit jackets. It turned into a collection of mini murals on people's backs, traveling to spaces where the patient's story has often been left out, where conversations about medical records often focus on how to make it work for the providers, the billers, the systems of care. Regina called it the walking gallery of healthcare. The idea was to remind everyone, hospital execs, policymakers, that we're all patients.
So these paintings are on the back of people. So when they go to health conferences, a gallery starts to form because there's these paintings literally walking down the hallway and you're walking amongst them. And the person who's wearing it becomes a docent of their life.
Holiday has over 400 jackets now. She doesn't sell them. Other artists are involved. And she has everyone from a homeless man in Baltimore to a lead doctor at a Kaiser Permanente think tank to the head of the White House Office of Health Information Technology wearing them.
I saw Regina's art for the first time, and I remember grabbing her hands and saying, "Thank you for giving me permission to be angry about what happened."
This is Whitney Zatskin. She was working in government affairs when she joined the gallery. It was after her stepmom died of bladder cancer, after early warning signs were missed. Now she's leading a project aimed at improving care. I met up with her and a few other people who are part of the gallery in D.C.
If you live in the policy world or the business world, and I live in several different worlds, often conversations are very based on ideas and economics and all these other abstract ideas, and they forget the real, true, everyday truths of being a person. I'm Lygia Ricciardi, and I work in the area of digital health and consumer engagement. I've also spent a lot of time in the federal government. This is a picture of me and my two daughters, and this was a story about me wanting to have a very natural
My jacket is about the not-so-good decision-making that went on when I was trying to decide if my daughter should start taking a step.
My name is Marilyn Mann. I volunteer with the American Heart Association.
I'm Anita Samarth. I'm the CEO of Clinovations Government and Health. Personally, this is less so about my health story, but the role that I play in ensuring that we think about patients in the center. I don't know, is this me on the back? And I guess, yes, I personally...
I love going to a new conference and going my first day without my jacket and then observing and then going my second day with my jacket and just quietly monitoring how the conversations change.
It's great because it gets people asking questions.
There's different types of people that'll run up to me and grab me and say, oh my gosh, I love the walking gallery. And there's a whole other world of people who were my best friends the day before that now are very like, oh, you're the weird punk rock chick in the corner. What are we doing?
Holiday and others say at first people seemed frightened, thinking they were angry patients. But she felt they were confusing anger with passion.
So to put a walking gallery jacket on the back of a business suit, which is an emblem of power, is really amazing. Because you take that really important space and you put a patient's story smack dab in the middle of it. And now you've reclaimed your power.
Now, the jackets have become more embraced in the digital health sphere. They're almost expected conversation starters, serving as a reminder of why people do what they do and what's at stake. Conferences often grant walking gallery members special access to events that would otherwise be really pricey. And in the world of healthcare and technology, that's a big deal. These are often the spaces where policies take shape, where leaders in the public and private sphere get their ideas. And Holiday says over the past 7 years, the whole field has been shifting in a major way.
Everything's flipping and changing. And so the patient experience has become really front and center these days compared to back then.
Patients are being seen more and more as partners in their care versus having care done to them. And patient portals or electronic messaging systems can make it easier to get information and lab results. A few weeks ago, at a big meeting of digital health companies and policymakers, some major players even announced a commitment to give consumers access to their electronic medical records. It's been 7 years now since Regina's husband, Fred, died, since she painted this mural depicting their roller coaster of care off this main DC street. Regina doesn't get back to this mural much. She lives about 3 hours away now. The mural has weathered some over time. And when we stop by, she notices a few areas where bricks and paint have chipped off. So she darts away and returns with some paint from a nearby store.
So right now I'm taking paint and I'm squeezing it out in my palette because when you have an outside mural, one of the things you got to do periodically is fix it.
She wants to repaint those parts that have come off to preserve Fred's story.
And I need a whole bunch of colors because I've got to match tone to the colors that are there right now.
Green and pink and orange
full
and yellow.
Palette. Yeah, it's everything.
Regina hoists herself up on the thin brick wall, about 4 feet high, almost as tall as her. She leans against the mural for balance. She then reaches up to an exposed spot in the gray-blue sheet that's wrapped around Fred, lying there, eyes closed, on that hospital bed. Just above her arm and paintbrush, Fred's own arm rests on that sheet. He's holding a piece of paper. On it is a message he wrote. It says, "Go get him, Regina."
I miss Fred. I miss Fred every single day. I mean, he was my soulmate, so it's sad. But on the other side of that, I've been put in a position in my life to try to make the world better, to help other people. And that's a blessing.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Regina Holiday's story is about access to information, but it's also about making sure that the human element in medicine isn't lost. That's another big complaint with electronic health records. Now there are computers in most exam rooms, and that can really come between a doctor and their patient. We wanted to talk more about this, so we reached out to physician Bob Wachter. He's one of the people really shaping the discussion as medicine goes through a digital transition. I started out by asking him, where do we stand on patient access to medical health records?
Well, it's very interesting. Patients have had a right to have access to their medical records for over 20 years. It's actually in federal legislation, but try to get your medical record from a hospital when it's paper. You have to find the records department, and they'll tell you it'll take 3 weeks, and it'll cost 75 cents a page, and you have 1,000 pages. So it's not at all easy or accessible. What's changed in the last few years is we've gone from about 10% of doctors' offices and hospitals having electronic records, up to close to 90% now. And so now all that stands between a patient and his or her record is a password, and more patients are getting full access to their medical records.
There seems to always be a bit of tension around this issue where patients are saying, this is my story, this is my information. And physicians, of course, have to keep records in a different way that's very efficient, and maybe the patient's story and suffering gets lost in there. Where do you see that tension that we sometimes see at conferences and with advocates like Regina?
Yeah, the tension is real. I think it really does have to do with almost two different ways of thinking about the medical record. And I think sometimes patients look at a doctor's when you hear a doctor's desire not to share the record, you think that the doctor is trying to hide things. Now, some of the time the doctor is, but some of the time I can tell you as a physician, if I see a patient and I take the patient's history and I want to remind myself or tell a colleague, I think this patient just has a simple viral infection, but I need to, we use the term rule out, I need to rule out the possibility that this is cancer or HIV. I'll write that in the record just to remind myself of that. But of course, if the patient were to see that, they don't think probabilistically the way we were taught to in medical school. They might look at that and be quite worried about it. So that's part of the tension. I think some of the tension is physicians will sometimes record things in ways that are indecipherable, sometimes record things that are somewhat pejorative. You know, this patient is, quote, difficult. And so, you know, we have to clean up our act. We have to make sure that the records are recorded in a way that patients would want to see. But this issue of physicians feeling free to record their thoughts in a way that helps them think through the case and how patients will take that, I think that is a real issue. The studies of this, though, have shown that patients seem to like having access to their records and are far less wigged out than we once were concerned.
You said sometimes a physician might write in the record, this patient is difficult. Why do they write that? Does it help another doctor? Does it help themselves?
A little bit of both. So there's actually a famous Seinfeld episode where Elaine goes to visit a doctor and picks up her paper chart and notices that it says that she's difficult, and spends the rest of her visit trying to get the doctor to erase it. And the doctor finally reluctantly agrees to erase it. And she notices that it was written in pen, and she says, "You fake erased." Why would physicians do that? Because some of the time we're trying to jog our memory for the next visit. So and difficult, obviously, is pejorative, and I think we probably shouldn't do that. But it is to say mostly to a colleague that if you see this patient, sort of be warned, this is someone who will challenge you or won't accept what you say. But it is pejorative, and I think the idea that patients will see the chart and the patients really own the chart, to me, overall is healthy. And if it means we have to clean that sort of thing up, I think that's a small thing to ask.
I talked to a couple of physicians about how electronic health records have changed their practice. And a lot of them use the term a curse and a blessing. So on the blessing side, they told me it made things a lot easier. They can, you know, get access to test results. They can order drugs more quickly. But on the curse side, they've said it's brought the computer in the exam room. Do you hear that a lot from your colleagues?
Constantly. And part of it is typing. But I can tell you I'm a pretty good typist, and it still is distracting and annoying. And part of the problem is that the electronic record has given license to all sorts of third parties, insurers, quality measures, to say, okay, now we can just ask the doctor to record these three or four or five more things to tell us that, you know, they did the right thing or, you know, they're practicing good medicine. It makes sense in a vacuum, but when you actually bring that into the record, it is the physician can feel like a slave to the record, and that the physician is paying more attention to making the record look pretty than making the patient feel heard and be well. And the blessing part is real, too. It's easy to romanticize the old days. Well, the old days weren't very good. You know, the handwriting was often indecipherable. You often lost records. You couldn't read them from home. Now there's something called decision support, where if I type in a medicine the patient's allergic to, the computer will tell me that and prevent me from a terrible error. So there are a lot of benefits, but I think right now the curses are quite real. And the rates of burnout among American physicians have skyrocketed in the last few years. And when you ask why, the electronic record is one of the prime reasons.
How so? What is it about that that makes it so hard for physicians?
Well, I think a big piece of it is simply a distraction. It is a feeling that I went into this business to connect with patients, to listen to them, to focus on them. And now I have turned into a rather unglorified and pretty expensive typist. Probably younger generations are a little bit better at it than we are because they grew up with that kind of multitasking. But I think everyone's struggling with it. And a big part of it really is we just haven't figured out what the appropriate place of the computer is in the exam room and also optimize the technology so it's less intrusive.
Bob Wachter heads the Division of Hospital Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and his book is The Digital Doctor. He told me he thinks a lot of these growing pains will ease in the next few years as record keeping gets less clunky. For example, he's seeing a lot of advances with voice recognition technology, which will mean doctors will not have to type as much. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find our podcast on iTunes. Today, we're looking at how technology is changing medicine. Doctors at Cook Children's, a pediatric hospital in Texas, are used to treating children who've been abused or neglected. But what they would really like to do is prevent these heart-wrenching cases from happening in the first place. Lauren Silverman reports on big data technology that could help.
Sometimes when a child who's been abused gets to the emergency room, it's too late.
We didn't know exactly what the injury was when he came into the operating room, but he had come into the hospital awake.
Physician Diane Daly remembers a tiny toddler who had been kicked by his father in the stomach.
And my job as a pediatric anesthesiologist is to keep the patient alive while the surgeon is fixing the damage. And in his case, we gave him so much blood and we tried so hard, but the injury was just not survivable. And it was an emotional time because of the type of injury he had and how close in age he was to my own children.
In 2013, more than 1,500 American children died from abuse and neglect. That's the most recent national info available. Last year in Texas, the Department of Family and Protective Services announced 170 children died. It says Tarrant County, which includes Fort Worth, Texas, has one of the highest rates of abuse in the state. That's where Diane Daly goes to work every day. She heads the Center for Prevention of Child Maltreatment at Cook Children's, a hospital in Fort Worth. Daly's been on a mission to train doctors and nurses to recognize the signs of abuse early, like suspicious bruises or marks. But detecting abuse is really hard, especially for infants who may not interact with teachers or nurses familiar with the clues. That's where something called predictive analytics could be helpful.
This type of technology has been used to predict where shootings would occur and other types of violent crimes, but no one had ever applied it to a domestic violence like child maltreatment before.
Here's what Daly's team did. First, they collected data on things like poverty, domestic violence, and aggravated assault. Then they crunched the numbers using free predictive software invented at Rutgers University in New Jersey. It's called risk terrain modeling. It spit out a forecast for likely locations of child abuse in Fort Worth.
And amazingly, we were able to capture 98% of the cases that occurred in the future.
So the technology identified specific locations in advance, actual blocks in a neighborhood where cases of abuse would occur. Predictive analytics is a huge market. It's part of a big data industry valued at $27 billion a year. And it's only recently that these tools are being put to work by nonprofits and local governments.
And we see some positive examples from around the world, in New Zealand, in Allegheny County, in Pennsylvania, in LA County.
UC Berkeley grad student Darian Woods studied how this technology is being used. One success story, Hillsborough County, Florida. After a rash of child homicides there, the government boosted the number of social workers and used predictive analytics to pinpoint the most urgent cases of abuse. Since then, for those under court-ordered protection, the number of child homicides has been zero. Woods warns that could be an anomaly, but that kind of success has caught researchers' attention. Still, even if predictive technology does pan out, there are thorny ethical questions that come with using statistics to judge whether children are safe.
You know, are we reinforcing racial inequities? So, you know, if there are more single mothers in communities of color, then maybe the model might target communities of color more. And so that may lead to more social workers being sent out and more children being taken from homes from those communities.
He points out that neglect and abuse also happen in wealthy communities, places that might not be flagged in traditional risk modeling. In Fort Worth, Diane Daly wants to use predictive modeling to target resources, not people.
So what we've decided to do then, knowing where these risk cluster areas are, we've started to work on how can we align prevention services in these areas where the kids need it the most? And how can we bring programs that will address the risk factors that are the most important directly to the place where the children need it the most?
Daly has big plans for this big data experiment. The next step, use the same predictive software to forecast abuse hotspots in the state's largest cities. For The Pulse, I'm Lauren Silverman.
Lauren Silverman is a reporter with public radio station KERA in Dallas. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show is about technology and healthcare today, and let's stick with the topic of assessing risk. Would you be willing to let researchers take a peek into your brain to see if they detect changes that are often an early sign of Alzheimer's? Would you really want to know? People across the country are participating in a study that reveals whether or not they have high levels of amyloid. That's a plaque that can build up in the brain and potentially destroy thinking and memory. The end game here is to see if an experimental drug that clears that plaque can prevent dementia. But first, scientists need to figure out which people have that plaque buildup. Tanya English followed one study volunteer as she took this test and got her answer.
Elizabeth Mosier says it's just something that she wanted to know. The first step is an injection.
I hope you find a good vein.
Yeah, we'll make a real tight fist. I get to use a small needle, so usually it's not.
A drug with a low level of radiation travels through her blood and lights up amyloid plaque in her brain.
So what I'm going to do is start an IV and flush it, and then I'm going to inject the dye, flush that through, take it out, and then you're just going to relax in here for...
Not a big deal. It's just like going to the doctor's office and getting a blood test. Didn't even hurt. I'm Elizabeth Mosier. I'm a retired Foreign Service officer with the State Department, and I'm retired in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania.
Is this something that you're worried about? I don't think most people go around thinking, oh, what if I have amyloid? You know, tell me a little bit about it.
No, I'm not really worried about it, just kind of curious. It's one of those things. I think it's probably my biggest fear as getting older is to have Alzheimer's. On the other hand, it's a very kind of affliction to have because you don't really know that you've got it. So in that sense, it's kind, but it's also a burden on the people who need to take care of you.
Mosier climbs onto a PET scan machine, and it creates 3D images of her brain.
I'm going to lie you down on your back, and we'll bring your head up this end. Feet down that way. I'll get a cushion from underneath your knees, okay?
Yes, that would be wonderful.
Now, this will take about 20 minutes.
Okay.
So like I said, you just hold real still. This will scan in and out. It doesn't make a lot of noise.
It's not something that people get tested for on a regular basis. So this PET scan is really quite valuable. It's a good gift. I'm interested to know what my amyloid level is, especially since I had two people in my family who had Alzheimer's. My Aunt Catherine was one of the most intelligent women that I had ever known. The last time I visited her, before it was discovered that she had Alzheimer's, she kept asking me the same question over and over again. Then, a few weeks later, I found out that she had been shopping and got lost and couldn't find the exit. I do not want to be an armchair granny. In my lifetime, I've had various physical problems, but the more I move and the more I do things, the better I feel.
Yep, so the following questions are about common tasks and activities such as shopping, planning, and meeting with friends.
At the beginning of the study, a research assistant has everyone fill out a questionnaire.
How often do you have difficulty preparing a meal for yourself or others?
The volunteers also play games on a computer tablet to test their short-term memory. As pictures of playing cards flash on the screen one by one, Mosier has to click if she's seen the card before.
So I'm going to hit start test for you.
Press yes if you've seen the card before in this test. Press no if you've not seen it before.
About 2 weeks later, the PET scan is ready, and Elizabeth Mosier is back to hear her results. If she has amyloid plaque buildup, that means her risk for Alzheimer's disease is high.
I'm nervous. Because if I don't have it, that's a relief. And if I do have it, there's a treatment that I might be part of. So in either way, it's a good thing to know. I'm excited to find out.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Are they testing you nonstop?
Yeah, I like it. It's fun.
You've had a scan. Any problems with a scan overall?
No.
No problems with a scan. So we do have the results of your scan, and the results did not show that you have plaque in the brain, elevated plaques in the brain at this time.
So, this is all pretty routine for the doctor. He moves on to talk about next steps and logistics. But for Elizabeth Mosier, it's a big moment.
I was holding my breath.
I'm so happy.
Very happy for you, too. Yes.
Thank you.
Good results.
Yeah, it did. Okay. Ha ha, no problem. Congratulations, we go out to dinner tonight.
69-year-old Elizabeth Mosier getting good news after a brain check at the Drexel Neurosciences Institute. Tanya English reported this story. Mosier will now join the control group for a big national study testing an experimental Alzheimer's drug. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about technology and medicine. A couple of years ago, I went to see a physical therapist after a car accident, mostly for neck pain, and he gave me a couple of exercises to do at home, just stretch my neck, basically. It was simple, it didn't hurt, and yet I found myself not doing these exercises at all. And then when I went back to the physical therapist, I lied about it. Sorry, Mark. But he probably knew that, because guess what? A lot of people don't do their home therapy exercises, even more so when the routine is difficult for them or it causes pain. And that can really impact recovery, especially after something major like a stroke. So would people do better if physical therapy was more engaging? Todd Bookman takes a look at a different approach.
So this is what popular video games sound like. Okay, compare that with what a game designed for stroke rehabilitation sounds like. Dr. Judy Deutsch will tell you it's not really a fair comparison.
You'd think this game might be really boring for a young kid. It wasn't designed for a young kid.
Deutsch is a professor at Rutgers University, where she researches how video games may be able to improve physical therapy outcomes. For instance, on the screen right now is a game she and a team of coders developed called V-Step. It uses the Microsoft Kinect motion sensor and camera, a $100 piece of hardware, to detect where the player's body is in the room. Deutsch watches a 77-year-old woman named Maria, who has limited use of her right arm and leg, try it out.
And so she's slow to move, she's a little bit uncoordinated, and she really presents with some of the movement problems that are very specific to what some of these games were developed for.
To play the game, Maria looks up at a screen, which has either blue or red blocks popping up randomly. Her job is to virtually step on them with the correct foot. It's a bit like the arcade game Dance Dance Revolution, but with no music or flashing lights. As she slowly, slowly works her way through the level, Maria is walking, kicking, or mimicking stair climbing, the same movement she would do in traditional physical therapy. Except there's a score being kept. And for whatever reason, That seems to make it less boring.
But I think it's more than not be boring. You want it to be meaningful, because if exercise is just at the level of the muscle and it's a repetitive nothing, nothing will transfer to real world action. So you want it to be engaging your cognition as well as your movement.
There's growing scientific evidence suggesting that these types of games, what are sometimes called serious games, may work, that they can get someone to put in more time and effort by breaking up the monotony, by getting people more engaged. What Judy Deutsch calls flow.
In other words, when you play the game, you're feeling it. You're in the zone.
The kind of zone you could get into playing, say, Wii Tennis. There was a lot of excitement over the rehab possibilities for Nintendo's gaming system when it first came out in 2006. But off-the-shelf games can prove too difficult, too distracting for people with limited cognitive or physical abilities. We're going to jump about 90 miles south now to a lab on Drexel University's campus in Philadelphia. Professor Paul Diefenbach, tall and skinny, is using his long arms to demonstrate the cardiovascular benefits of his serious game. This one is called Collect. You grab and kick at different floating shapes, balls, fruit, cats.
And I'm actually a little bit out of breath now from playing the game, which is what the goal is.
Diefenbach used to work with NASA on developing simulations for life inside the International Space Station. Those tools were sophisticated and priced out of reach for most university professors.
There had been similar technology I'd been working on 20 years ago, but it required $100,000 computers with $50,000 systems. Now that we can get systems in the $100 to $200 range, it's opened it up to everybody.
Diefenbach and his team at Drexel are developing a series of games for their new company, Enable Games. They're designed for kids and adults with lifelong conditions like cerebral palsy.
This is a very underserved population that we're dealing with. In addition to the physical and cognitive challenges that they have, they're very isolating conditions.
To help these users connect with each other, the games will have leaderboards and online messaging systems. And the whole idea here is that a physical therapist could assign a patient, say, 1 hour of gameplay a day to get their heart rate up and muscles moving, instead of other exercises they may not be all that inclined to do.
And yeah, a lot of what they have to do is at home. And if it's really something that they don't value or they're not invested in, it's not going to happen. It's, you know, the dog ate my homework.
Dr. Maggie O'Neill has heard all the excuses during her 30 years of pediatric physical therapy. She's also a professor at Drexel doing research on patient outcomes. Since the games collect data, not just how many lemons you grab, but also detailed information about how many degrees you flex your elbow, she can track progress over time. But there's another metric that's a little harder to predict.
Are you going to make money off this?
I don't know. Maybe. That's not the primary goal, but it wouldn't hurt.
It would be helpful if Enable Games or Rutgers V-Step make money, because that's really the only way anyone will ever get to use the technology. Again, Paul Diefenbach.
If it was going to be just a university project, it would live and die in the university, as I've seen so many projects do. So it was really important for me that we commercialize this to actually get it into the hands of the people that need it.
And keep those hands and arms and legs moving during longer and hopefully more fun, less serious rehab sessions. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. More technology to the rescue in our next story. Kansas City native Rob Jefferson, a music lover, suffered gradual hearing loss for years until he lost all of his natural hearing ability. He's 56 now, and a few years ago, he got cochlear implants. The promise of this technology was to restore his hearing, but he discovered that relearning how to hear doesn't happen with the flip of a switch.
Music was a big part of growing up. Starting in the fifth grade, I started playing saxophone. I listened to everything from classical music to the pop, the country, the rock of the day. I first started notice that loss in my hearing in my late teens, probably about 18 years old. Once I got into late 30s, early 40s, music appreciation and understanding had gotten to the point where I just couldn't even listen to music anymore. I couldn't understand it. So 2 weeks after the surgery, I go back to the audiologist. The audiologist put everything together, and she told me that she was getting ready to turn them on. And she said that once she turned them on, she would let my wife speak first. The audiologist wanted to make sure that the first sound I heard was my wife. Unfortunately, I probably upset my wife, because once they turned on the processors, the first thing my wife said was, "I love you," but I couldn't really understand what anybody was saying. And then slowly, I heard a word, and it's like I understood that. And then I picked up another word, and then another, and then it all started falling into place. The only thing was, is it wasn't a natural sound. Everything to me sounded very robotic. I tried to explain it as if you'd ever listened to Styx growing up, their song Mr. Roboto. That's what it sounded like. I have heard people tell me that the first voices they heard sounded like Mickey Mouse on helium. I've had others say that everything was Donald Duck. Even had one gentleman tell me that everybody that spoke sounded just like Darth Vader.
The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant.
To me, that would be really cool. I had the robots. I do remember coming out of the audiologist office, and there was a tree, and I couldn't figure out what I was hearing. My wife happened to be with me at the time, so I asked my wife, "What am I hearing?" And she said, "Describe it." So I did the best I could on describing it, and she just pointed at the tree. She said, "Well, just look up. It's the birds." And I actually stood there for a couple minutes watching the birds chirp, sing, because I don't think I'd actually heard birds since my early 20s. So to be able to hear that again was really, moving, emotional for me. I actually was rather anxious about listening to music. Voices weren't perfect yet, and I was really kind of afraid, if I turn music on, am I going to be completely disappointed? And I would say it was probably a couple months after the processors were turned on that I actually sat down to try to listen to music. It was a struggle at first. I couldn't distinguish a guitar from a drum. They all sounded the same. And then I thought, maybe I'm just trying to listen to music that's too complex. So I backed way up and went to very simplistic music. And the song that actually came across and I could understand the vocal and the instruments, this really dates me. Love, love me do. You know I love you. With the Beatles, Love Me Do. It's just a simple three-chord song. The percussion is very simple. It's a nice, easy song. And I knew at that point that music can come back.
Rob Jefferson of Kansas City talking about his cochlear implants. Alex Smith from KCUR Public Radio produced this story. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today has been about technology and medicine, and we came across a really fun story online produced by Joel Werner of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. It's about a couple, David and Yvonne Trinidad, and they both got fitness trackers, which ended up revealing a surprising piece of information.
Yeah, I mean, we've been together 8 years, married for now 3.5.
He and his wife made a New Year's resolution that's probably familiar to a lot of us, to get fit and healthy. So they each bought a Fitbit, a popular wristband activity tracker, and for David at least, the device worked pretty much as you'd expect.
So far, so good. I've actually lost about 9 pounds, which is probably what I gained over the holiday week, to be honest, but at least I'm back to where I was before. It's helped me get more active. I've been hitting my step goal, walking more. I can't really have too many complaints about the tracker.
But his wife, on the other hand,
she nudged me in bed last week and said, "Hey, I think something's wrong with my Fitbit." I saw that she had accumulated 10 hours in what they call the fat burning zone. And her average heart rate was close to 100 with, you know, spikes up to 115. And that was a pretty normal day for her as far as working at her job. It wasn't like she was running a marathon or anything like that. I thought, okay, maybe something's defective with the watch. Maybe for some reason the sensor's broken, or maybe she's not wearing it correctly, or maybe it needs to be reset or recalibrated in some way, shape, or form.
So David took to the internet in search of a solution. He posted a description of the problems with his wife's device in the Fitbit subreddit, an online message board that hosts discussions for Fitbit users. And at first, the replies were kind of just shots in the dark.
So I got a couple of answers, you know, one saying, "Hey, the latest Fitbit update has messed with the sensor a little bit, so that might be an issue."
But then, something way more intriguing. A user posted,
"Hey, has she been really stressed out lately, or is it possible that she's pregnant?" You know, right away I panicked a little bit because, you know, we had for about 2 months been trying to have our first child, so I knew it was a possibility. I responded immediately and said, "Pregnancy is a strong possibility. And if that's the case, you know, then if I'm going to be a dad, I need to worry about my heart rate at this point."
But had the internet got it right?
I called my wife and I said, "Listen, you know, these people on the forum suggested that you might be pregnant." So she went to the store that night, got a test, took the test, passed the test, I guess you could say. And then I made her take about 6 more tests in probably a 12-hour span, which all came back positive. I think like any parents, we were overjoyed, a little bit shocked, definitely a little bit scared. But, you know, overall, we were just really excited. We laughed about the fact that somebody on Reddit kind of predicted it. You know, I actually found out that my wife was pregnant through Fitbit.
This story was part of a larger feature on the science of fitness trackers produced by Joel Werner of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I hope you can join us for a science festival event here in Philadelphia on April 26th at 6:30 at the Franklin Institute. It's called 2066, A Science Odyssey, and we're going to talk about what the world will be like 50 years from now. For more information, go to our website at whyy.org/events. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next week on The Pulse, do pets have rich emotional lives? Do they feel shame, guilt, schadenfreude, jealousy? Science tells us no way, but pet owners say, of course.
He gives me this look.
What's the look?
He's like, "Really, Mom? Really?"
Why we think that our pets are thinking what we're thinking. That's next time on The Pulse. Don't miss it. Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.